This is Dr. Stan here on Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, and hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it will be reality and not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. As you know, our purpose is to try to convince you that today America is at war. At war between two diametrically opposed world visions. One which believes that America is a nation where people should be free. They believe in freedom under God. They believe in individual liberty. On the other side, there is a world vision that says that man must be registered at birth with the government. He must be monitored during his education, and his education shall be devised by the government. He shouldn't be too smart, because if he's too smart, he can read and think. He won't go along with the sort of government that is planned for him. His job must be regulated. His health care must be provided for. His disability payments and workman's compensation, everything must be provided for this man, because he's really incapable of providing for himself. And because some would be rich and some would be poor, we want everybody really more or less in the same economic status. We want to take from those who have and give to those who have not. Of course, unless you're one of the ruling aristocracy, and then you're in a different category. And then as you grow old, why, you'll have retirement benefits and then death benefits, cradle to the grave control over you. One philosophy that believes that America is the greatest nation that has given the greatest freedom at any time in history. And the other philosophy, this other worldview that believes that America and its constitution should be submerged into a new world order, where all men in all nations will be equal under the new ruling aristocracy. Well, these are rather incredible ideas, and most people seem to find it very difficult to believe that such things could be going on in our society today. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, before this evening is over, I hope to convince you that this is exactly what is happening. Well, let me start out here with a quotation that comes from Patrick Henry, one of the great patriots, one of the founding fathers of the United States, and he made this statement in a speech to the Virginia Convention in Richmond in March of 1775. Here is what he said. It is natural for man to indulge in the illusions of hope. We're apt to shut our eyes against a painful truth and listen to the song of that siren till she transforms us into beasts. Is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? Are we disposed to be the number of those who, having eyes, see not, and having ears, hear not, the things which so nearly concern their temporal salvation? For my part, whatever anguish of spirit it may cost, I'm willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and to provide for it. And this evening, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to tell you the worst. I'm going to tell you what a few people in America know. Those of you who are regular listeners to Radio Liberty may certainly know what I'm about to tell you, but most people don't know. And the reason they don't know is because of the degree of control which exists today over what the American people think. It was back in the late 1950s or early 1960s when a prominent United States senator made this statement. And he was actually included this in the congressional record. And you want the reference to this, all you need to do is write to us. We'll give you a free copy of None Dare Call It Treason. Oh, send us a dollar. It'll cover postage and handling. Somebody gave us a lot of copies of this. This was a very important book. It was published back in 1964. But I think that you should get it and you should read it. And you should try to determine the sources from which we will be talking to you tonight. So first of all, here's what United States Senator William Jenner said. We have a well-organized political action group in this country determined to destroy our Constitution and establish a one-party state. This political action group has its own local political support organization, its own pressure groups, its own vested interests, its foothold within our government, and its own propaganda apparatus. The important thing to remember about this group is not its ideology, but its organization. It is a dynamic, aggressive, elite core, forcing its way through every opening to make a breach for collectivist one-party state. It cares nothing for party changes directed by the sovereign people. It has a strategy which is not delivered from anything known to the two parties. Outwardly, we have a constitutional government. We have operating within our government and political system, however, another body representing another form of government, a bureaucratic elite, which believes that our Constitution is outmoded and is sure that it is on the winning side. That's what Senator Jenner, it was included within the congressional record. However, for those of you who really want to check out the source material, you can still get at the libraries, they haven't all been burned yet, copies of Barry Goldwater's book, With No Apologies. And on page 277, Barry Goldwater published this book back in 1977. Barry Goldwater talked about the organization which controls both political parties and makes mockery of the democratic process in America. And this is what he says, and I'm quoting now page 277. In its September 1st, 1961 issue, the Christian Science Monitor described the Council on Foreign Relations as probably one of the most influential semi-public organizations in the field of foreign policy. The Monitor went on to say, the Council on Foreign Relations is composed of 1,400 of the most elite names in the world of government, labor, business, finance, communication, the foundations, and the academies, or the academies, I'm sorry. It has staffed almost every key position in every administration since that of FDR. In September 1939, two members of the Council on Foreign Relations, Hamilton Fish Armstrong and William H. Mallory, visited the United States State Department to offer the services, or their services, of the Council to the State Department. They proposed to do research and make recommendations to the State Department without formal assignment or responsibility, particularly in four areas, that of security, armaments, economic and financial problems, political problems, and territorial problems. The Rockefeller Foundation agreed to finance this operation and this plan. And from that day forward, the Council on Foreign Relations has placed its members in policy-making positions within the federal government, not just limited to the State Department. Since 1944, every American Secretary of State, with the exception of James F. Burns, has been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Almost without exception, the members of the CFR are united by a congeniality of birth, economic status, and educational background. A number of writers, disturbed by the influential role of this organization and the part it's played in determining foreign policy, have concluded that the Council on Foreign Relations and its members are an active part of the communist conspiracy for world domination. To support this construction, they cite the fact that since the end of World War II, the free world, and the United States in particular, have suffered an unbroken string of defeats at the hand of world communism. Their syllogistic argument goes something like this. The Council on Foreign Relations has dominated American foreign policy since 1945. All American policy decisions have resulted in losses to the communists. Therefore, all members of the CFR are communist sympathizers. Now, many of the policies advocated by the CFR have been damaging to the cause of freedom, and particularly to the United States. But this is not because the members are communists or communist sympathizers. This explanation of our foreign policy reversal is just too pat, too simplistic. I believe that the Council on Foreign Relations and its ancillary elitist groups are indifferent to communism. They have no ideological anchors. In their pursuit of a new world order, they are prepared to deal without prejudice with a communist state, a socialist state, a democratic state, monarchy, oligarchy. It's all the same to them. Rear Admiral Chester Ward, USN retired, who was a member of the CFR for 16 years, has written, the most powerful clique in these elitist groups have one objective in common. They want to bring about the surrender of the sovereignty and the national independence of the United States. Their goal is to impose a benign stability on the quarreling family of nations through merger and consolidation. They see the elimination of national boundaries, the suppression of racial and ethnic loyalties, as the most expeditious avenue to world peace. Their rationale rests exclusively on materialism. They believe economic competition is the root cause of international tension, and this approach dismisses as insignificant the form of government or the political ideology expressed by that form of government. Now, it may be that if the CFR vision of the future could be realized, there would be a reduction in wars, a lessening of poverty, a more efficient utilization of world's resources. To my mind, this would inevitably be accomplished by a loss of personal freedom of choice and the reestablishment of the restraints which provoked the American Revolution. When we change presidents, it's understood to mean that the voters are ordering a change in national policy. But since 1945, three different Republicans have occupied the White House for a period of 16 years, four Democrats have held this most powerful post the world has to offer for a period of 17 years. With the exception of the first 7 years of the Eisenhower administration, there has been no appreciable change in either foreign or domestic policy and its direction. When a new president comes on board, there's a great turnover in personnel, but no change in policy. Example, during the Nixon years, Henry Kissinger of the CFR and Nelson Rockefeller's protege was in charge of foreign policy, and when Jimmy Carter was elected, Kissinger was replaced by a Zbigniew Brzezinski CFR member and David Rockefeller's protege. And then he goes on to talk about how these people have dominated America's foreign and domestic policy. Now, you'll never see that talked about, unfortunately, the American people are not to understand we really do have a ruling elite. Now, probably we owe Bill Clinton a debt of gratitude. And I say this in all sincerity, because Bill Clinton probably was the best thing that ever happened to America. He did more to make Americans aware of the fact that we were losing our freedom, that we could not depend upon government. He's done more to demonstrate that than any other president we have ever had. But even more than that, when Bill Clinton was nominated for the Democratic nomination for the President of the United States, and he addressed the mass Democrats on July 16, 1992, Bill Clinton talked of his vision for America. And in the process, he talked about the man who had given them that vision. And he said, you know, when I was a student, and I was a very young man, I heard their vision espoused by John Kennedy. And then when a professor, when a student at Georgetown University, I heard that same vision put forward by a professor named Carol Quigley. Now, to understand who Carol Quigley was is to understand what is happening to our society and why the American people don't understand what's going on. I might point out that on the 10th of November, 1994, Bill Clinton went to Georgetown University, where he had been a student, and addressing the audience at the Foreign Service School, he gave the first inaugural Carol Quigley lecture. And he once again mentioned the vision of Carol Quigley and identified with the vision of Carol Quigley. What was that vision? Well, Carol Quigley wrote a wonderful book. It was called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. It was 1,348 pages long, and it gave the entire history of the world and really who it was who controlled the government of the United States and how it worked behind the scenes. And I'd like to quote to you briefly what Carol Quigley said on page 950 of his opus, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Carol Quigley is talking about the fact that there are a lot of stupid Americans who really believe that there's a world communist conspiracy. And Joe McCarthy believed in a communist conspiracy, and a lot of these right-wingers believed in a communist conspiracy. And they believe that they're working to take over the world, and how ridiculous these right-wingers are. And then on page 950, Bill Clinton's mentor, Professor Carol Quigley, goes on to say this. This myth, like all fables, does in fact have a modicum of truth. There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network, which operates to some extent in the way that the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Group, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other group, and frequently does so. I've known of the operation of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and many of its instruments. I've objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies, mostly, in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown. And I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. And then he goes on to talk about the covert organizations, the secret societies, and how it all fits together. This is Bill Clinton's mentor, the man who gave Bill Clinton his vision. Let's go to page 324, when he tells how banking influences what's going on, because all of these organizations tie into banking, and these secret organizations tie into Lazard Brothers, And, of course, most people think that's a Jewish organization. It's not Jewish at all. They push forward the Jewish bankers to conceal what these people are really doing. And, of course, we could go back in history and we would find that the same forces that were tied into this group were instrumental in creating the protocols which were instrumental for the vicious persecution of Jews in both Russia and Germany. And the Jews have been pushed forward to be the scapegoats while people never were allowed to know who was really running things behind the scenes. So let's listen to what Professor Carol Quigley says about international finance, which incidentally is not Jewish. In addition to these pragmatic goals, and he's talking about international finance, the powers of financial capitalism have another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. And, of course, as you read the financial pages of your newspaper, you'll find that the central bankers are meeting all the time, making decisions as to how the economy of the world is going to put together. And Professor Quigley goes on to say, the apex of the system was to be the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. You see, all central banks are private corporations. They are government banks. They're privately owned. Every central bank in the hands of men like Montague Normal of the Bank of England, Benjamin Strong of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, Charles Rist of the Bank of France, Heimar Schacht of the Reichsbank, sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. In other words, go along and you'll get along in the business world. When you get out of government, they simply buy and purchase the politicians, as we saw with Newt Gingrich recently in his $4 million advance on a book he hasn't even written yet. In each country, the power of the central bank rested largely on its control of credit and the money supply. In the world as a whole, the power of the central bankers rested very largely on their control of loans and of gold flows. In the final days of the system, these central bankers were able to mobilize resources to assist each other through the BIS, that's the Bank of International Settlement, where payments between central banks could be made by bookkeeping adjustments between the accounts which the central bankers of the world kept there. The Bank of International Settlements, as a private institution, was owned by the seven chief central banks, which were operated by the heads of those who together formed its governing board. And each of these kept a substantial deposit at the BIS and periodically settled payments, etc., etc. And he is simply explaining how the world really works behind the scenes. Now, this is a fascinating book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, written by Bill Clinton's mentor. The book basically gave the whole story of how the whole concept of these new ideas to dominate the world started back with John Ruskin at Oxford University in the 1870s, inspiring a generation of the youth of Oxford, among who were men like Milner and Asquith and Gray, and those names don't mean too much to you, Cecil Rhodes. But you'll remember Cecil Rhodes, they named a country after him. It was Rhodesia. He came to control the gold and diamond mines of South Africa, and he established the Rhodes Trust. And, of course, the Rhodes Trust then became an organization that would bring young men from all over the world to go to Oxford to be indoctrinated in socialism and internationalism, to go back to their home countries, and to push those political philosophies. And as the publications of the Rhodes Trust say, talking about America, young men would go to Oxford, they would take their training, they would come back to America, and they would go into government, they would go into the media, they would go into education, they would go into banking, they would join the Council on Foreign Relations. And of course, Bill Clinton followed the rules. He understood how the game was played. He went to Oxford, he became a Rhodes Scholar, he didn't finish there, but he came back to America, joined the Council on Foreign Relations, was picked in early 1992 to become the next president of the United States by these people. Of course, they were running George Bush as well, but George was told, of course, that the Bill was going to win. And if you remember that during the last part of the election in 1992, George Bush was just going through the motions. he wasn't really trying to win very hard. Of course, they ran Ross Perot to pull some of the conservative votes away just to make sure that their man, Bill Clinton, got in. But it really didn't matter. You go back to 1988, and you had Michael Dukakis, Council on Foreign Relations, running against George Bush, Council on Foreign Relations. There have only been two people who really have been presidential candidates in either the Republican or Democratic Party, going all the way back to the time of Harry Truman, with the exception, of course, of Harry Truman, who got into the presidency by accident with the death of FDR, and Lyndon Johnson, who got in by accident with the death of JFK, or I don't really believe it was an accident, but both political candidates, other than Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, they've all come from the Council on Foreign Relations, but Barry Goldwater wouldn't sell out to them. And Ronald Reagan, unfortunately, after a visit from Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford, who was rewarded for his loyalty to these people by becoming the vice president and then eventually the president following Richard Nixon, after a visit from these two men, Ronald Reagan agreed to go along with them and allow them to dominate his government, although he brought in many of his original friends. Each one of them, whether it be Lynn Nofziger or Allen or McFarland or Meese, they were all either came under vicious attack. And by the end of the Ronald Reagan term in office with the Iran-Contra scandal, he was simply struggling. Ronald Reagan was struggling to keep from getting impeached. So you must understand that the Secretary of State literally always comes from these organizations, the head of the CIA, the head of the Federal Reserve System. Only one head of the Federal Reserve System, going all the way back to 1913, has not been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and that was a fellow named Marion Echols, and most of you never heard of him. That was back in the 30s. Well, anyway, this was a wonderful book that Professor Carol Quigley wrote, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, 1,342 pages that laid out the whole history, how the Rhodes Group formed a secret society and eventually dominated the government of South Africa, led to war in South Africa. Why? Because war was how you changed the world. And then, of course, by the time of the First World War, why they were in complete control of the British government, and one of the members of the secret society was the foreign minister who got England into the war and then perpetuated the war and kept it going when everybody wanted to get out of the war. But you see, they realized that war was how you changed the world. And 30 million people, 30 million human beings, either were crippled or died as a result of that terrible war that was specifically and intentionally prolonged and kept going by the people under this Anglophile group that Professor Quigley talks about. Well, we won't try to go into the whole history. This is beyond the scope of our discussion this evening, because I want to tell you what happened to Professor Quigley's book. You see, we have censorship in America. And yes, Virginia, if you're listening out there, there really is not only a Santa Claus, there is censorship in America. And there is an organized effort to keep people from learning the truth very often. Now, it's very difficult to demonstrate actual censorship, but fortunately, in the case of the book written by Bill Clinton's mentor, Tragedy and Hope, written by Professor Carol Quigley, back in 1980, when I went through Professor Quigley's papers back at Georgetown University before anybody had a chance to launder them or sanitize them, I found a tape. And I purchased the right to use that tape from Professor Quigley's widow. And this is the tape you're going to hear now. You're going to hear the voice from the past of Professor Carol Quigley, as he will tell you many interesting things about secret societies, and it's interesting to listen to him because he's very contradictory in much of what he says. He finds it very difficult to agree that there are secret societies. And then he tells how the plates to his book, Tragedy and Hope, were actually destroyed by the publisher. Why would any publisher destroy the plates to a book? Well, maybe somebody doesn't want people in America to learn the truth about America's invisible government. So, without further ado,
for more than a year, which would be to the end of 44. By that time, we were ready to take over and move them in and so forth. Now, in that group, there were 55 who already had PhDs, you see. Mm-hmm. So it was a very good group. The only one I had any trouble with had been a district attorney in Indiana and a Republican politician. And I had trouble with him over certain things. For example, the Civil War in Spain. I gave him the truth of the Civil War in Spain. I mean, this is not a communist revolt against the Catholic Church or something like this. You see, and that's what this guy was. So this is the substance of the book, Tragedy and Hope.
Did you know while you were working on this?
No. I was just trying to, keep a day-to-day basis.
But you realize at the end of the accumulation research and...
Well, yes, I knew a hell of a lot more about most of this than most people. Mm-hmm. Now, I then spent 20 years writing it, from 45 to 65, and put it in, you see, in 65. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I had written a shorter book, which 15 publishers had rejected, and I had set it aside. I wrote it the first time in the only summer I had off, which was 1942. In that whole period, I went for 20 years without any time off. No sabbaticals, no anything. From 42 to 60, 61, when I took off and went to England to research. And then I got another sabbatical in 71, when I again went to England on a sabbatical. And I only, and so they owe me sabbatical time, whether I'll get it or not. I've asked for a one semester sabbatical before I retire. That simply means I get full pay for one semester. Excuse me, a half day or whatever it is. I don't know what it is. I can't even look in. I don't find time, have time to look in it. But in any case, I worked out all of these things, and my first book had been rejected by 15 publishers. I had written it first in the summer of 34. I then spent the summer of 42 in Princeton, in Donald Stauffer's, and he died as Eastern Professor of Literature at Oxford after climbing the Pyrenees, running up and down the Pyrenees. And I rewrote it in 42. Then I set that aside and wrote it a third time, just dashed it off. And that is the book, The Evolution of Civilizations. It's only 279 pages, but it's still the best thing. And there are a number of books that quote it as the best thing on why civilizations rise and fall and how they do and so forth. So it's a big thing, you see. Now, this world since 1914 covers 70 years, from 1895 to 1965. And in that way, but it covers the whole world. So again, it's a pretty big thing because it goes into science and technology, as you will discover if you start reading the paperback, and economics, and you see, I can do more in economics than economists can.
Well, one thing that intrigued me, well, just last night my wife and I was talking about this, was the title of the book, Tragedy
and Hope. Yes, because
it's such a large title.
Yes. Now, what it means is this. I think it is absolutely tragic. It is shameful. It is sinful. Western civilization is going to go down the drain. When I wrote that book, which is less than 10 years ago, I had hope that we could save Western civilization. I am extremely skeptical now that it can be saved. I think we're just about finished. And I just threw a few things out here this morning in the class. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're going to allow a coal strike, and if we're going to overthrow the Portuguese government. Because as soon as we, all these modern dictatorships are not going to last, so we get rid of a democracy because it wants to be a little liberal. Mm-hmm. And we put in a military dictatorship, but then collapses, and what happens? The communists come in. Mm-hmm. This is what happened in Portugal. Salazar was there since 1927. You see? Mm-hmm. All right, now they suddenly try to establish some kind of a non-military dictatorship. He wasn't a military, he was a college professor, but he was supported by the reactionary groups. And now they want to do something about that, and the same thing could happen in Greece. They're now going to probably in Greece try these generals who established the military dictatorship because we got them to do it, you see. And this gives the communists, and it could well be, now this is what's worrying Kissinger. He thinks the whole Mediterranean has been a communist. So we're going to go into war to prevent this? Oh, I mean, it's sick.
Well, let me go back.
Now,
when did you find a publisher for your book?
I found a publisher instantly because the first book, I'm in current history, an editor. And I used to write a good deal for them. And that's who called me up one Monday and wants me to write about Spain today, what's going to happen in Spain. And I said, it would take too much time, I don't do it. So the people of current history said to me in 1960, I just mentioned I had this book, I had many books. I have a whole lot of books, half written and almost wholly written, you see. And they said, have you ever going to ask Peter Ritten? And I said, I never heard of him. Who is he? Call him up. At McMillan. So I'm right to the phone. I was at the American Historical Association in New York, the meeting of 1960, and I went to the phone and called McMillan and asked for Peter Ritten, and he came on, and I said, I have a book, and I have somebody here who's the editor of Current History, says that you would like it, and so forth. He said, send it to me. A week later, I got a letter from him. It's a marvelous book.
How many pages did you send him?
I sent him the whole thing.
Which was?
And well,
fat.
Yeah, just about that fat. It came out as a book of 279 printed pages.